Thank you, Paul. So if we could have the slide on the screen, please, that'd be great. We're going to be thinking about this. It's interesting, isn't it? It doesn't happen very often that Easter Sunday falls on the same day as April Fool's Day. We're going to be thinking about this question. Is it a fool? Is it a foolish thing to believe that Jesus actually died and then came back from the dead? Now, boys and girls, what is a fool? Well, a fool is someone who is a bit silly, a bit stupid, who believes things without really thinking about it. Who says, oh yeah, I think that's true, but hasn't bothered to think it through and to examine the evidence. So, if we believe that Jesus died and came back from the dead, are we fools? Are we fools if we say, I'm going to follow Jesus and put my trust in him and obey him and live for him? Is believing in the resurrection, that it's true, a bit like believing that Peter Pan and unicorns and Superman are true and real and so on? Well, to answer that question, we need to ask another question, and it's this. What is it that tells us the resurrection happened? Where do we actually find out? What place do we go to that says, yes, this is a fact, this actually happened? Well, the answer to that is easy. It's the Bible that tells us in the New Testament, in the Gospels, and we just read from the Gospel of Matthew, part of the description of Jesus dying and then coming back from the dead. Okay, fine. But that raises another question, doesn't it? This, can we trust the New Testament? Because if it's the New Testament documents, the Gospels, that tell us that Jesus rose from the dead, can we trust them? Are they reliable? Are they accurate descriptions of facts? Or are they kind of exaggerations? Are they more like myths and legends and so on? Have they just been kind of embellished and brought up to create an amazing story? It's really important that we know the answer to this question, isn't it? And so we're going to look at some evidences, some different pieces of evidence. Now, boys and girls, what is evidence? Here's a little definition for you. A piece of evidence is something which helps you tell whether something's true or not, helps you figure out whether something really happened. Like on TV, you sometimes have a detective and they're investigating whether a crime happened or not. And what they do is they gather all sorts of pieces of evidence and that helps them tell whether this crime really happened or not. And we can do that when we think about the New Testaments and whether we can trust them or not. So I have here with me my box of evidence, all right? And in here are some artifacts, some things, some pieces of evidence that will help us to decide and to see whether or not the resurrection really happened. So I'm going to open the box. I've done it out like I'm pretending to be a detective, from what I know about detectives from watching TV dramas and so on. So let's look at the first piece of evidence. Here it is. There you go, in a detective plastic bag that I forgot to seal. This is a manuscript copy of part of the New Testament. It's actually Luke's Gospel, the Codex Sinaiticus. And I went on the British Library website. They have part of that in the library. There's other bits around the world, like Germany and other places like that. And this is the first kind of full manuscript. But all around the world are different copies of the New Testament. What happened was this. Eyewitnesses, boys and girls, an eyewitness is someone who sees something. Okay, I've just witnessed a blue car driving past. I'm an eyewitness of that car. What happened was people saw Jesus die and then come back from the dead. And then they wrote down what they saw. Or some other people who didn't see it talked to the people who did see it. And they wrote down what they saw. And then over time, people made copies of what was written down. And then copies of those copies. And copies of those copies. Until there were all sorts of copies of copies of copies all around the world. Now, when we look at any historical document, we need to see whether it's reliable. And historians tell us it's very important that we know how many copies of the manuscripts there are. The more copies of the manuscripts there are. Boys and girls, this is a question on your sheet now, so make sure you're listening. The more manuscript copies there are, the more reliable, the more trustworthy the document is considered to be. So, does the New Testament have lots of manuscript copies? Good news, it does. It definitely does. About 5,000 Greek manuscripts are in existence, and about 19,000 manuscripts in other languages like Syriac and Coptic and so on. Compared to other historical documents that are considered trustworthy, the New Testament has loads more. So yes, that's a piece of evidence where we see actually it shows us that we can trust the New Testament. Let's move on then to evidence number two. All right, so can you see what this is? A watch representing time. Because when we're thinking about ancient documents, time is a very important thing to consider. We need to ask this question: what's the time gap between when the events happened and when they were written down? And, boys and girls listening, the shorter the time gap, the better. The shorter the time gap, the more reliable those historical documents are considered to be. And again, good news, there is a short time gap between when Jesus died and rose from the dead, when he lived his life, died and then rose from the dead, and when those people who are eyewitnesses wrote down what they saw. Jesus sort of died and rose around AD 30. The New Testament was written around about between 50 and 100 AD. And that's really good because it's short compared to many other historical documents. And it's also good because the shorter the time gap, the less time there is for people to forget and to get it all mixed up in their minds. And also, if somebody back then wrote down Jesus died and rose again, read what was written down, they could actually find the eyewitnesses and talk to them and find out for themselves. So there was plenty of opportunity to locate the people who actually saw Jesus, ask them, what did you see? And check out, are they sane? Are they normal people? Are they just liars making it up? So there is a short time gap. That's great. That's another piece of evidence that shows us we can trust the New Testament. Let's move on to our third piece of evidence that we have in our books, in our box, sorry. And it's this. I got this out, Reading Central Library. It's by a man called Tacitus. He was a historian, and it's called The Annals of Imperial Rome. It's a history book that was written a long, long time ago, almost around the time of Jesus. Because when we think about any historical document, we need to ask this. Do other ancient manuscripts confirm the New Testament? Do they back it up? Do they corroborate it? Do they talk about the same kinds of things? It would be a bit strange if the only place where Jesus was mentioned was the New Testament. Then we think, really? No other writings around that time even mention him at all? But the good news is that lots of other writings do mention Jesus and do mention like things about his followers and all sorts of things like that. So we know that, okay, there really was a man called Jesus. I've put the page number on here. You can help yourself afterwards. It's fascinating to read what Tacitus thought about Jesus and about his followers. Actually, it wasn't just Tacitus. Lots of ancient writings, Tacitus, Thallus, Marabas, Serapion, Pliny the Younger, Suetonius, Lucian, Celsus, Josephus, the Talmud, lots of different writers who weren't Christian, who actually weren't even pro-Christian, Romans, Greeks, Jews, who were kind of not really interested or against Christianity. They wrote down different things about Jesus. It's quite astonishing, actually. Even if we didn't have the New Testament, we'd still know a lot about Jesus. We'd know all this. We'd know his name, place and time frame of his ministry, ambiguous nature of his birth, name of his mother, brothers, fame as a teacher, as a miracle worker, and so on, so on, so on. So there are quite a lot of facts from historical documents that are not the New Testament. And they back up, they tally with, they link with what we do read in the New Testament. Now, obviously, the New Testament is the one that says the most about Jesus. But that's really good. That's another piece of evidence that means we can trust the New Testament. There are lots more pieces of evidence. And maybe you're a skeptic. Maybe you're thinking, yeah, Easter. Yeah, it's just like, you know, Superman or Jesus rising is just on the level of Superman or Peter Pan or something like that. If you are a skeptic, in the lobby there are some books and they're free for you to take. One of them I recommend, it's called The Case for Easter. An investigative journalist who used to work for the Chicago Tribune. His wife became a Christian and he thought, I really need to check out whether this man called Jesus actually did rise from the dead. And he investigated it using his skills when he was a journalist. Please take a copy and have a read. There are other books in a similar vein. They're free if you promise to take them and read them. Okay, so you can trust the manuscripts. But maybe you're thinking this. Oh, wait a minute. Yes, we can trust the New Testament. But maybe you're thinking this. Can we trust the New Testament writers? Because what about them, you know? They were the ones who actually interviewed eyewitnesses or wrote down what they saw. Are they trustworthy? Can we work out? Is there evidence that tells us that they're trustworthy? Well, there is. And we're just going to whiz through three pieces of evidence that helps us see whether the writers, the people who wrote down the New Testament originally, can be trusted. So, what have we got here? Okay, we have a magnifying glass. Because detectives, they investigate things carefully, don't they? They get out their magnifying glass and their other equipment, and they carefully gather the evidence and compile it and work out whether it's more likely that something happened or less likely. Now, this means that we need to check this question. Did the writers of the New Testament intend to accurately write down the events that happened? Was that their intention? Did they say, I want to carefully compile an accurate account of what happened, a factual portrayal of history, not just some made-up thing? So did they? Well, they did. It was their intention. One of the Gospels is called Luke. And this is what Luke writes. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you've been taught. So it seems that there was this man called Theophilus, and he'd been taught lots of things about Jesus, but he really wanted to know for certain. So he asked Luke, can you interview people and write down stuff and compile it? And Luke said, yes, it was his intention. I want to make an orderly account, not just an embellished account or just a fudged account. I want to do this really carefully. And when you read the other Gospels as well, you can see that they're written with care. There's attention to detail. The way they're compiled is very specific. They don't read like mythology. That's very clear. C.S. Lewis studied mythology at Oxford University. He knew what mythology was like, read thousands of mythological descriptions and documents, and said, the New Testament just doesn't read like that. So that's another piece of evidence which convinces us we can trust the writers. Let's move on to our fifth piece. What do we have here? Can you see that? It's a model of a human brain, okay? Because the human brain is a very wonderful piece of equipment, isn't it? But sometimes the human brain doesn't remember things very well, does it? We jokingly call it our forgettery, don't we? Rather than our memory. Because you know what? They may have intended to write things down accurately, but were they able? Did they have the ability to record the events accurately? Well, back then, not much information was written down. It was an oral culture, meaning that information was spoken and then committed to memory. That's how information was passed on. That is not like our culture at all. We just don't really bother with our brains, do we? Because everything's written down. You kind of joke about it, don't we? Who needs a brain when you've got Google? Everything can be written down. And we rely on that, but they didn't have that to rely on. So they were used to using their minds to remember. And they used memory aids, like sometimes things were sung. It's easy to remember a song, isn't it? They had emphasis on certain points of a story that had to be got right. They were good at remembering things. And that's not, we know that, don't we? There are Muslims today who can memorize the whole of the Quran word for word. Amazing brain power, isn't it? There are actors who memorize hundreds of lines of Shakespeare and then act on a stage reciting all these lines accurately. The brain is very powerful, isn't it? Also, it's important that we understand this. We remember extraordinary events better, don't we, than just ordinary events. They stick in our mind. In fact, sometimes when we've had really significant, horrible events happen to us, we find we can't forget them. They just lodge there and stay there. But it's the significant things that stay with us, don't they? I want to give you an example of this from my life. About 30 years ago, I was 10 years old, playing in my parents' garden. Had a lollipop in my hand. I was enjoying licking the lollipop, just messing around in the garden. I saw a snail. And I thought, oh, a snail. Yeah, I love snails. And I was looking at the snail and walking around and kind of put my lollipop down and then kind of carried on with the snail. And then I got distracted by the water butt. I loved the water butt because there was these weird sort of maggoty things that swam around in it. So I got distracted trying to fish them out. And then, forgetting that I'd put down my lollipop and I had a snail in my hand, I put the snail in my mouth. And I never forget that, the sliminess and the horribleness of it all. It's just seared into my memory. But we have memories like that, don't we? Not just funny memories, but you know, when our children were born, we got married, things like that. We might not remember details like what colour was so-and-so clothes they were wearing or something, but we remember the significant things. It's easy to remember them. We don't almost have to make any effort. And the disciples would have remembered Jesus because everything he said was so different, so extraordinary. What he taught, what he did was just so memorable. So it wouldn't have been, they would have been capable, would have been able to remember and record accurately what they saw. Let's move on to our last piece of evidence, okay? Here we go. This represents a human being, okay? Now, human beings, we're amazing, aren't we? We're capable of a lot. But one thing we know about humans, because we know it about ourselves, is sometimes we can tell lies, right? Sometimes we can twist the truth a little bit. Human beings are very good about that. So we need to ask, were the New Testament writers truthful? Really important, isn't it? Did they tell the truth? Well, the evidence comes down on the side of, yes, they did. Because they'd followed Jesus. Jesus stood for the truth. He said, I am the truth. He taught them to tell the truth. He taught them to be honest. It would be very odd if after living with him and receiving his teaching, they just told this massive lie and kept on telling it and kept on telling it. That would be strange, wouldn't it? Also, what did they have to gain if it was a lie, from insisting that it was a lie? Did they gain fame? Did they gain a lot of money? No, they didn't. In fact, they gained persecution. Some of them lost their lives because they insisted that Jesus rose from the dead. People don't normally tell a lie and are prepared to die for it, are they, if they know it's a lie? It'd be very unlikely that they were lying. So we can trust them. The motive is just not there for them to insist on the truth. It just wasn't something it would have been a struggle for them to make it up because resurrection just wasn't even thought about back then. Nobody really thought it could happen. It wasn't something that was popular. It's unlikely they were telling a lie. Okay. We can trust the New Testament documents. We can trust the New Testament writers. But maybe you're thinking, fair enough, we can trust them, that's great. But so what? Why does it really matter? Why is it important? How is it relevant? How does the resurrection affect me? Why should I bother with it at all? Perhaps it did happen. Perhaps it was really wonderful because the disciples got their friend back. Well, we're going to finish off by thinking about that. And there's lots of reasons, but I want to focus on two reasons as we finish as to why the resurrection really matters. Talk about how it affects us. First of all, the resurrection brings us justification. We read that in Romans chapter 4, verse 25. He was, that's Jesus, delivered over to death for our sins and was raised to life for our justification. Now, what is justification? Boys and girls, this is on your sheet, so you might want to listen carefully at this point. Justification is when God counts Jesus' righteousness as ours and declares us to be righteous if we believe in Jesus. Okay, it's a declaration from God. I declare you to be righteous. God gives us Jesus' righteousness as a gift when we trust in him and declares us, even though we're not, he says, I treat you, I declare you to be righteous. Now, that's a very strong concept in the Bible. It's taught in a lot of places, but it's a bit difficult to get your head around. So I want to show you visually how justification works. So maybe Francis, you could come up and hold the cross. And maybe Johnny, you could come up, please. Now, Johnny is going to represent Jesus, okay? This is what we remember at Easter, isn't it? Jesus dying on the cross. Now, Jesus lived a perfect life. And this t-shirt, as you can see, is perfectly white. There's no stains on it. There's no blots on it. There's nothing. And it represents Jesus' purity, his righteousness. Righteousness is when we do what's good and right. He didn't slip up. He didn't sin because he was the Son of God. So maybe, John, you could pop that t-shirt on, just representing Jesus' perfect life. Now, Marin has volunteered for this. Marin represents us, human beings. And I've also got a white t-shirt for her to put on. But this represents our lives. And as you can see, it's very different to that t-shirt, isn't it? Because, sadly, this is the reality. Our lives are stained with sin. We might present well outwardly to one another, but God sees into our lives and he sees these things. He sees stealing, not loving God, breaking promises, cheating, being rude, name-calling, being selfish, ignoring God, lying, dirty thoughts, disobeying your parents, and so on, hating. These are sins that stain our life. So I'm going to ask Marin to put that t-shirt on because it represents us. That's the reality, isn't it, of what we're like as humans. Now, at Easter, when Jesus died on the cross, something incredible happened. There was an exchange. Could you both take your t-shirts off, please, and exchange them? Thank you. Well, we'll start with Johnny first. So, even though he was pure and perfect and innocent and sinless, when Jesus was dying on the cross, he took our sin on himself. God counted him as if he was sinful and punished him on the cross. And the Bible said when we believe in Jesus, the punishment we deserve, we escape that. We're saved from that because it fell on Jesus. But when we believe in Jesus, something else happens. As well as our sin being counted as Jesus's. Do you want to pop that on, Marion? Jesus' righteousness is counted by God as ours. So when God looks at a Christian, he says, I'm not going to punish you because I punished Jesus for your sins. And I count you as righteous and pure as my son was. Jesus lived the life we couldn't manage to live, and he died the death we deserve to die. And that's called justification. When God counts Jesus' righteousness as ours. And the resurrection brought that about. Jesus' death on the cross dealt with our sin. The resurrection enabled Jesus' righteousness to be counted as ours. Thank you, volunteers. You can sit down now. Thank you, Francis, for holding the cross. And that truth of justification matters. It's not just a theological thing that we have to understand as Christians. It's a wonderful thing that affects us deeply. It matters because God accepts us totally. God doesn't accept us on the basis of our goodness because we've got stains of sin all over us. He accepts us on the basis of Jesus' goodness, his perfection, which he counts as ours when we trust in him. So we can come to God with complete confidence, knowing that God loves us because our sin has been dealt with on the cross. Jesus' righteousness is ours. We're clothed in the righteousness of another, of Jesus. We don't have to earn acceptance with God. And that gives us peace. That makes us think, wow, God, you love me despite my failings. I don't have to always be thinking you've got this big frown on your face when you look at me. Because when you look at me, you see Jesus. But justification only comes to us when we trust in Jesus. If you haven't trusted in Jesus and his death and resurrection, then it's not yours. So God will have to punish you for your sins. God doesn't count you as righteous. Doesn't accept you on the basis of another's performance. That's why it matters. The cross and the resurrection get us to heaven. Get us acceptance with God. Mean that he loves us and will never leave us. It's the first important thing that the resurrection brings to us. But let's finish off with this. The resurrection means that we don't have to be afraid. We're going to watch a video clip now. And it's from the Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Now, boys and girls, a man called C.S. Lewis wrote the Narnia books. And he invented them. They're not true. They're just made up. They're all about a lion called Aslan. He wrote them to help us understand more about Jesus. And just as Jesus died, Aslan died. Now, I want us to watch carefully and see the change that happens to Aslan's followers when they see what happens to him. The change in them, the wonderful change. I love that. That's what it expresses. We can think about Jesus' followers experiencing that same kind of change. They were sad. They were sorrowful. They were afraid. They were wondering what was going to happen. And then Aslan comes back. And that's what happened with Jesus, that change. Look, we read about it earlier in Matthew's Gospel. The women hurried away from the tomb, afraid, yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly, Jesus met them. Do not be afraid, he said. And we don't have to be afraid if we've believed in Jesus. If Jesus had the power to defeat death, he has the power to look after us. If he, even when he's lying on the tomb, is in control of the situation, even when it seems as if it's all gone horribly wrong, he's in control and he comes back, then he can be in control of our personal situations, even when things seem like they're going horribly wrong. He's in control. If he has authority, even over death itself, and he has authority over our lives to help us when we encounter situations which just seem insurmountable. The resurrection brings us freedom from fear. It means we don't have to be afraid as we face our lives in the future, because Jesus' power and authority means that he can deal with whatever's thrown at us. He's in control of our lives and he'll be with us as we go through them. So as I finish, I want to ask you this question. Will you, if you haven't done so already, believe in Jesus already? That's the call of Easter. Come to him. Think about that visual reminder. Think about, yes, I am stained with sin, but I believe in you, Jesus, that you died for my sin. And when I trust in you, not only do you take my sin on yourself, but I get your righteousness. That's how we get acceptance with God. That's how we get to heaven. Will you rise with Jesus this Easter? Rise into a life of joy knowing you accept it. Because that's what justification does for us. It's not just a fact. It changes us on the inside. It makes us enjoy God. It enables us to have a relationship with him. It makes us want to serve him. So we have new desires. We don't just feel, oh, I ought to serve God. I love you, God. I'm so full of gratitude. And will you rise into a life without fear? Life where being scared doesn't have to just always be with you. But as soon as you feel fear, you can hand it to Jesus, who's got the authority and power to deal with that fear, whatever you're scared of. Will you believe in Jesus this Easter? Thank you for listening.